This is Brian Forrester, and welcome to the Active Investor Podcast, our monthly look at what's happening across asset management and how investment leaders at our firm are thinking about markets and opportunities today, as well as strategies that can help investors navigate different challenges. Today, we are bringing the discussion to an area of the market that has attracted a lot of new investor interest, and that is in investment-grade floating rate securities. A big part of that space is in CLOs, or collateralized loan obligations, in addition to areas of other securitized products. Now, some new ETFs have brought attention to this space and have attracted investors looking for yield and to finally get out of cash after the massive Fed move in 22 and part of 23. And with a new rate environment today, where there's once again a more normal environment with some attractive yields and a growing realization we may be in for an environment of staying higher for longer in terms of rates, this area of floating rate opportunities within IG is rapidly gaining a lot of attention. And so on today's podcast, to help make sense of all this, we are happy to have someone here who has a very deep understanding of fixed income, and that's Adam Castle. So welcome, Adam.
Thanks, Brian. Great to join you today.
So Adam is a partner at Lord Abbett and leads our specialty finance team in fixed income, which is a significant part of what makes up many portfolios at Lord Abbett. And he is a portfolio manager on a number of our most successful and widely owned investment strategies, from traditional fixed income to opportunistic credit, and then to a product we launched last year focused specifically on investment-grade floating rate opportunities. And that last area is where we're going to focus today. I thought first, though, we could start off just asking you, how did you get into fixed income investing? And kind of why have you gravitated towards this area of specialty finance, areas like securitized?
Sure. Thanks for the question, Brian. I entered the industry in 2008, having graduated from Cornell University, really as the financial crisis was just sort of unfolding, but not having yet reached crisis mode. Lehman Brothers was still around. Fannie and Freddie were still around. But housing was front and center at that point. Knew a lot about super sieves and CDO squared, way more than anyone who ordinarily would know entering Wall Street, simply because it was in the news all the time. And this idea of public policy and housing and securitization all coming to the forefront, a need for a true overhaul and a rebirth of that industry. And I was just really attracted to what was going to be an exciting time. And so when I joined AllianceBernstein out of school, joined the fixed income department there, and I have been in that world ever since. Became a banker at Credit Suisse doing securitization, and have been here at Lord Abbett for the last 9 years helping lead our securitized products investment.
Interesting. And I'm going to touch back a little bit later. You mentioned CDO squared, and maybe we'll talk a little bit around the difference between some of those products and then CLOs today. So my next question to you then would be around the current fixed income and interest rate environment, the macro environment. Where do you and your team see rates, inflation, the bigger macro picture? And then maybe also, how should investors looking to reallocate out of cash today be thinking about things like where do you get yield or limit your risk and finally get off the sidelines?
That's a great question. I'm going to actually take the latter part of it first. So, you know, right now, the best opportunity in the bond market is in higher quality assets. You see actually a much bigger dislocation there in terms of relative value of higher quality corporate and securitized product relative to their historical averages, more so than you do in riskier parts of the market like high yield and bank loans. And I think what's happening there is risk-taking is certainly taking place. There's a decent amount of optimism around a soft landing. There's certainly evidence of a pretty stable economic backdrop with an economy that's been able to handle high interest rates. But for those with a lower risk tolerance, or for any money that is simply lower risk tolerance, the yield on treasury bills is simply good enough. And so it's that highest quality part of the market that would typically be invested in by some more shorter term or lower risk tolerance money that is really being ignored. And so that's where we see some of the best value right now. Okay. So, sorry, I can go into question number one, or we can keep going down this path. Up to you.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of touched on it there. And just, I mean, do you have a thought on just, you know, you're hearing now that beginning of this year, it was like 6 or 7 cuts are coming. Now you're hearing that we're potentially having none or maybe even a hike in 25. I mean, is that kind of where you guys are thinking as well in terms of just interest rate path from here?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple things that go into our thinking there. First, you've got the level of inflation right now in the mid-high threes, right? Coming off the highs materially of call it 9% 18 months ago, but still far away from the 2% target that the Fed has.
Right.
Now, intermediate term inflation expectations are still actually right around 2-2.5, depending on what tenor you're looking at. So the market is currently in this position where it has faith in the Fed and it has faith in the idea that inflation will come down, even though it's been staring at a mid 3% number actually for this year, and it's been rather persistent. So I think, and we think, that one of the pressure points on interest rates right now is the persistence right now of inflation being in that mid-high three number. And at what point is there going to be some capitulation? Right now, with interest rates in that mid 4% level, depending on whether you're looking at the 2, 5, or 10, we think that there's more room actually for some increase in yields there as the market starts to consider pushing out the stickiness of inflation. There's absolutely been evidence that things have been, you know, easing up a bit. Q1, there was plenty of economic data which suggested that the economy was slowing down a bit, and there was some, you know, good data that suggested inflation was coming off. However, there are certainly signs out there that inflation could inflect higher.
Right.
So, you know, for example, multifamily construction had been coming off quite a bit. That, you know, we've seen completions were pretty high last year, but they're starting to decrease, right? So there's a possibility for a resumption in rent increasing, more like what we saw in 2022. Certainly the residential REITs are talking about that kind of increase, you know, coming off of the, you know, inflecting off of 2023 growth trend. You've also got the labor pressure potentially building. So we've had a dramatic influx of immigrants over the last 3 years, and that has undoubtedly helped alleviate pressure in wage growth on the lower end, you know, parts of the labor market. But really, regardless of who we get as president in November, we should expect to see a reduced volume of that, and that could lead to some market forward-looking views toward wage pressure increases. Yeah. So, you know, I think at this point, our house view, and I'd say at least the majority of the portfolio managers here at Lord Abbett, are thinking that there are going to be no cuts for the year. There are certainly PMs here who think that a cut will transpire. Mm-hmm. And then regarding next year, you know, right now there are about 4 cuts priced in for 2025, and the range of expectations ranges, but there's absolutely a strong case to be made for the Fed not cutting this year and then potentially having to entertain a hike. Nothing like, you know, the 500 basis points of moves that we had over the last hiking cycle, but a tick or two does seem like it could be in the realm of possibility.
Yeah, let's hope not. So, I mean, big shift there from some investors all talking about, you know, having a big increase, looking for duration at the beginning of the year, and now kind of thinking like, I want to stop trying to figure out where rates are going. And so, you know, that kind of leads into an area like floating rate and investment grade floating rate. And so maybe talk a little bit about this area of the market in particular and why it's compelling both today, but maybe also as a strategic long-term investment.
Sure. So I think bond investors typically have had to make a choice regarding how to spend their risk budget. They can spend it on duration, they can spend it on credit risk. Typically, to the extent you want to avoid duration risk, you can buy a floating rate product, but many floating rate opportunities in the market historically have been of lower quality, you know, something that is not investment grade. So the really interesting thing about higher quality floating rate assets is that they afford an investor an opportunity to spend their risk budget on credit risk, but high quality credit risk. Traditionally, high quality investments, you think about the Bloomberg Aggregate Index and, you know, the vast amount of assets in core bond funds that exist in the world, those are fixed rate, they're high quality. Mm-hmm. So investors who are looking for quality have historically ventured towards also adding quite a healthy dose of duration, you know, the index typically being in that 5 to 7 year duration, you know, zip code. So if you could dissociate the two, then we think that there's something very appealing there. Over the last 50 years, we've been in a secular decline in interest rates. And as a result, duration has been a very, you know, important tailwind to thinking about the returns attribution of any ag-based product. You could say that the 60-40 portfolio itself is based off of the data that's really surrounding a multi-decade decline in interest rates. Well, what if that's no longer the case? What if, even if interest rates don't rise, what if they simply stay the same? Then you're kind of spending a risk budget on duration that might be better off being spent collecting carry in terms mm-hmm. of credit. And that's where we think the application could be pretty interesting right now.
Okay. So then if we go in a little bit deeper into what I referred to earlier and on CLOs, and you brought up in your background coming, first of all, that must have been fun coming into the market in 2008, very interesting times. But you mentioned CDO squared and, you know, a lot of the products that, you know, certainly got a lot of attention in the financial press and the popular media that were, you know, sort of right at the epicenter of the financial crisis. So can you explain a little bit, you know, why this is an attractive space, but also distinguish, you know, CLOs today versus some of those products from 2008?
Absolutely. So today, CLOs are very simplistic vehicles, actually. They're in a sense, you know, their own standalone miniature financial institution. It's a vehicle, a trust that owns bank loans and issues debt in order to capitalize itself. No different than really a bank or a specialty finance company that makes loans or makes leases or other financial assets and capitalizes itself with a combination of debt and equity. The reason why CLOs have taken off is really a result of the post-global financial crisis paradigm, where banks had to really shy away from taking credit risk in terms of the assets that they were putting on their balance sheet. So banks became, you know, lenders and certainly expanded their balance sheets post-GFC, but it was all in incredibly high quality assets, prime mortgages and such. And so the CLO became a home for the way, you know, the rest of American corporations would have a little bit of leverage on them finance themselves. But ultimately, the construction of the CLO mimics a bank. You have debt that is issued that is collateralized by the assets in the trust, the loans in the trust. And that's very similar to any old traditional, you know, financial corporate bond. The way we see CLOs, they are effectively a de-levered exposure to corporate credit. And there are certainly layers of proximity to the true credit risk that you can get the lower down you go in a capital structure, meaning the lower tranches that you go down in a CLO capital structure. But ultimately, it's a very appealing place for us to get spread, credit spread, while having a healthy, you know, distance between the bond that we're investing in and the underlying credit risk itself.
Gotcha. Yeah. And when you look at the historical default rate of investment grade, especially AAA down to single A, it's virtually nothing. So, I mean, that's certainly not saying that nothing can ever happen. You know, we're not making any forward-looking statements here, but the historical track record has been pretty compelling from a risk standpoint, at least in terms of defaults. So given that backdrop, maybe you can take maybe one step further and then talk a little bit about how your team manages in this space and the strategy that you launched last year, the investment grade floating rate strategy, how you look at CLOs within that, but also the broader portfolio.
Absolutely. So anytime we think about investing in an asset class, a securitized product, asset class in particular, we have to make sure that we believe we can form a scalable edge in that asset class. And those are two key words. The edge needs to be because we can create tools and have exceptional talent and ultimately form an investment process which will create repeatable alpha. And the scalable means it can't just be something tiny. It has to be something that we think will be durable, large, long-lasting, mm-hmm. not a boom-to-bust type of trade, but a truly scalable skill set that we can apply to all of our portfolios. And the more we've looked at CLOs, the more we see exactly that. So collateralized loan obligations are a very self-regulating ecosystem. The amount of capital that is needed to form one is vast, and the risk to form one, to be the equity investor, is high. And so the risk premium that investors take in forming a CLO is actually, you know, quite punitive. An equity investor in a CLO typically requires a mid to high teens rate of return. As a result, you end up with a very self-regulating ecosystem where, to the extent underwriting standards or defaults increase, you get a very quick feedback loop where the cost of equity rises and the underwriting standards thus have to tighten in order to keep the economic picture attractive enough for the capital. And it's that tight feedback loop that leads to a very stable market structure. You think about the contrast to subprime mortgages before the global financial crisis. You know, we had multiple decades of kind of looser lending standards against houses, a conventional wisdom that home prices would continue to appreciate, thus masking a lot of the credit risk that was actually being taken. You had the use of teaser rates and other sorts of unconventional mortgage products that delayed a lot of the realities regarding a consumer's ability to pay. And so you didn't have a tight feedback loop. In fact, you can make bad behavior happen year in and year out, more than a decade even, before really figuring out that a problematic credit cycle had begun. Here we have a much tighter feedback loop because of the economics at stake. And of course, the debt markets are pricing CLO debt with a hell of a lot more risk premium today. And that creates, again, the need for the tight feedback loop. And so that is a sustainable, scalable edge that we can bring to the market. And of course, we've built a lot of resources around it as a result. We have a pretty deep team. We have a pretty large technology budget. And we use a combination of an innovative tech stack, our ironclad reputation, multi-sector awareness, all to create a very high conviction and differentiated approach.
So, I mean, that's definitely an interesting take. And I think it's something that is going to get more visibility as investors look at this type of product. Speaking of these types of products, I mentioned earlier, there are a couple of ETFs out there that have gained a lot of assets in a very short period of time. And I think that's probably a function of this new market environment, more normal market environment, but probably a higher level of rates for longer. And so investors may be starting to look for yield in these types of products. So I think most of them are more just all AAA exposure and CLOs. Talk to me about how you think about those products or your team thinks about those products and why what you do is maybe like a better way of investing in this space.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the use of ETFs in CLOs really has been a boon for liquidity. Mm-hmm. I think that these are tools that are here to stay and have allowed for an institutional application that is really terrific for the asset class. But the current suite of offerings that we've seen are fairly blunt instruments, you know, investing only in AAAs, for example. Ultimately, the thesis for investing in one of those ETFs really goes back to all the earlier comments about the value of higher quality floating mm-hmm. rate assets. But the truth is that if you have a little bit of room for more nuance, you should take it in a multi-sector strategy like what we bring to the table. There are many high quality floating rate assets out there that exist across the bond market, CLOs being a huge opportunity set, but not the only one. And then secondly, within the CLO capital structure, you have different rating categories. You have a AAA, a AA, a single A, and a triple B, all within the investment grade part of the universe. And then you also have non-investment grade parts of the capital structure too. And the relative valuation between those tranches and their ratings is something that fluctuates frequently. And at any given time, there might be a part of the capital structure that is more attractive than the other. And it could be a fleeting opportunity. It could be a deal that's struggling to get across the finish line on a summer Friday where we can provide a clearing level. It could be something in secondary related to, you know, an interesting trading opportunity that's been shown just to us and happens to be a double A or single A. Those types of opportunities, given the scale and breadth of our platform, are great for a multi-sector approach to high quality floating rate. There's nothing bad I could really say about those ETFs. They are phenomenal, but we think there's a lot more room for some alpha generation. And if you look at our product in particular, you will see that differential.
Yeah, I just actually jotted down a couple of ways I might call them like applications for investors. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but like number one, I would think just for this huge amount of cash that's on the sidelines, that was sort of waiting for rates to go down, and now there are these kind of products that can give you a significantly more yield with not a big pickup in risk. So just kind of getting from cash first probably is also a good complement to, you know, an existing intermediate holding that maybe you don't want to get out of that. But if you're kind of tired of having to kind of predict where rates are going, this is kind of like a way to get more exposure to potentially more yield, but without sort of punting a little bit on the direction of rates. And then, as I said earlier, I would think, and I think you alluded to, is if you have sort of a lower credit quality allocation to floating rate, this could help complement that or maybe even replace it with a higher quality, but still not giving up really much yield at all. Do those make sense?
They certainly do. And I think, you know, to your middle point, I mean, right now the curve is inverted. So if you are, you know, choosing to allocate duration to your portfolio, you're not really getting paid for it. So you're doing it because you're taking a bet on interest rates. And I would argue that for high quality bond investors who have limited risk tolerances, reconsidering how to allocate that risk tolerance. There's a ton, as we were talking about earlier, high quality credit risk out there that you actually get paid handsomely over treasuries to do. You can earn a 6-7% yield, potentially more, while taking very, very minimal amounts of credit risk and staying near the front end of the curve versus going out the curve where it's inverted to buy that duration. Is that duration earning you any money? Not really. It's the curve's inverted. So you're buying it because of its commodity aspect, of the fact that you think it will rise in value. And that, you know, look, duration is absolutely something that has merit in a portfolio. But again, if you think about the last 50 years and the secular decline in interest rates, it's worth taking a second look at how much duration is really the right thing right now.
Yeah. All right, good stuff. So with that, I think we can wrap things up. And I'll just say thank you, Adam Castle, for joining the podcast. Some really interesting insights today in the areas of opportunity of investment grade floating rate. And it may be a compelling opportunity, I think, as we talked about today, for many years. Definitely look forward to having you back again.
Thanks, Brian. Great to be here.
Great. Thanks, Adam. And for listeners wanting to learn more about Lord Abbett's views on the markets, please visit the insights section of lordabbett.com. We actually have a newly published article on IG floating rate investing that touches on a lot of what we discussed here today. And lastly, we'd also like to hear from our listeners. So if you have any comments about today's podcast or ideas for future podcasts, we welcome your thoughts and just email podcasts@lordabbett.com. And so we'll leave it there. This has been Brian Forster with the Active Investor Podcast, and thank you for listening.
This podcast is intended solely for informational purposes and is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation. The contents are based on available information at creation and subject to change. It is not intended as investment, legal, or tax advice. Lord Abbott is not acting as your fiduciary. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments involve risk, including the loss of capital. Certain information contained herein has been obtained from third-party sources, and such information has not been independently verified by Lord Abbott. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbott speaker are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. References to specific asset classes and financial markets are for illustrative purposes only. Neither Lord Abbott nor the Lord Abbott speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered. The information in this podcast does not constitute an offer or solicitation in any jurisdiction. This broadcast is the copyright 2024 of Lord Abbott & Co. LLC, all rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or any form without the permission of Lord Abbott. Lord Abbott Mutual Funds are distributed by Lord Abbott Distributor LLC. For additional information on risk and a glossary of terms used in this broadcast, visit lordabbott.com. This episode was recorded on June 27, 2024.